This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This is all theater. This is all just political theater.
Political theater. Political theater.
Pure political
theater.
Theater.
Political theater.
The nefarious,
significant, and protracted
political theater for political theater's sake.
I yield back.
From Washington, this is Political Theater. Roll Call's review of the spectacle of politics on Capitol Hill and across the country. I'm Jason Dick. The HBO documentary series Obama in Pursuit of a More Perfect Union arrives at a tumultuous time in American politics. It explores the formative years and presidency of Barack Obama, an era that seems both far away and contemporary, with race relations continuing to define the public sphere. The three-part series premiered on HBO and HBO Max on August 3rd, just in time for Obama's 60th birthday this week on August 4th. As part of the American Film Institute's AFI Docs 2021 Documentary Film Festival, I moderated a post-screening discussion with Peter Kuhnhart, the director and producer of the series, and Jelani Cobb, staff writer for The New Yorker, producer and contributor to the series, and one of the country's most prominent journalists covering race, culture, and politics. Peter and Jelani, I just want to congratulate you on a really well done job with this documentary series. I mean, the breadth of it, you know, I mean, I think that most people who are kind of political junkies or documentary junkies have seen something about the Obamas or President Obama, but this has a real depth in terms of the biographical aspect and the political aspect too. And I just want to, the framing device for which you put the film together with the speech is sort of colloquially known as the race speech that Obama gave during the primary in 2008 when he felt he needed to address this head on with Jeremiah Wright coming into the limelight and also some of the stuff that was going on in South Carolina. Peter, let me start with you about what went into the decision to, is that how you wanted to organize it from the get-go around that, using that, the speech as the frame for this story?
Well, the decision to begin with the speech came a little later, but the decision to look at Obama's life and career through the lens of race came at the very beginning. And I should take you back. We started this project 7 years ago when Obama was still president. And at that time, the issue of race was something that nobody in the administration wanted to talk about. It was like the third rail that every time it was brought up, something kind of went haywire. So my feeling is that time was on our side, and the fact that it took as long as it took to make this film liberated us and allowed us to talk to people around him about the issue of race and how it impacted his life and his presidency. So race was always the central figure in this project.
And Jelani, you're a staff writer at The New Yorker and a professor of journalism at Columbia University. You've been chronicling the politics of Barack Obama, the politics of race for most of your career. I remember the first time I heard your voice, it was, I believe, on a podcast. I mean, I can't remember. I know you've done something recently on The Ringer. It was way before that, though. When did Obama get on your radar as an observer of these issues? You mentioned that when you heard his DNC speech in 2004, this is in the film, where you say, like, of course there's a Black America and a white America, regardless of that aspirational, but had you heard about Obama before then?
Yeah, I'd heard about Obama prior to that 2004 DNC speech. And, you know, there was this halo around him and, you know, this, just laudatory stream of compliments, you know, that were associated with him, which I was primarily hearing from white people, you know, if I'm honest about it. And it made me skeptical of him because, you know, I thought, like, okay, transactionally what exactly is happening, especially for this Black person to be so widely embraced by and wildly popular with so many white people. And you know, is a person in that position able to actually be a credible representative of Black interests? And when I heard the DNC speech, I both had increased reason for skepticism and increased reason for endorsement. You know, he was a far more complicated and compelling figure than I had anticipated. And so the DNC speech was the first time I saw him in any extended light. And then, of course, Mattis only grew. He was greatly complicated what I thought of him then. And that was the defining trait of, I think, his presidency, that things only got more complicated as time went on.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about Al Sharpton's comments during the campaign, and this is also documented, Peter, in some footage you have of Reverend Sharpton, where he says that the more he said that he just didn't want me to hurt him. He didn't need my support outright, but he didn't want me to hurt him. Mm-hmm. And that was also, he said, like, the more that I talked to him, the more I heard that he wasn't going to tell me what I wanted to hear, which mm-hmm. was, it sounds kind of like what you're saying, Joanne. Mm-hmm. Like,
mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. And I also think that, you know, one of the most brilliant things that he did in 2008, which I don't know if we'll ever see anything like this, was almost to, you know, kind of make a football analogy, where this is a person who, you know, receives the ball at the 5-yard line, and there's nothing but defenders, you know, in front of him, and it's just navigating. You know, there's the civil rights establishment, there's the Democratic Party establishment, there's the general public that's skeptical of him. There's, you know, people who realize immediately that Obama rhymes with Osama. You know, like, there's no reason to believe that this person is going to be able to make any headway. And just as a political spectacle, I mean, it was just astounding to see. And so even the commentary that Al Sharpton made about saying that, you know, he didn't want him to hurt him. And I think people at some point came to the realization that as he grew in popularity, it would be injurious to themselves to attack him. You know, you saw the civil rights establishment recognizing very quickly that Obama was, in some instances, and this Congressional Black Caucus, for that matter, in some instances, Obama was more popular with their constituents than they were. And that was an astounding thing to see happen.
And Peter, you mentioned that this project took years, you know, to pull together, which, I mean, it feels like a years-long project because of just the depth of the coverage you have of him as a young man at the Harvard Law Review and so forth. And then there's no way that you could have planned this, but, you know, this film is arguably more relevant now than when Obama was president because of what we are dealing with as a country. We just recognized the 1-year mark of George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis at the hands of police officers. Joe Biden just recently went to Tulsa in to mark the 100th anniversary of the massacre of Black citizens there. And Donald Trump brought race to the fore as an antagonistic weapon in politics the last 4 years. What was going through your mind as you're in post-production for this, you know, really gargantuan kind of undertaking?
Well, we were as surprised as everyone on election night when Donald Trump was elected. I mean, you'll probably remember Obama's astonishment that next day when he was being interviewed, and he looked like a deer in the headlights that he just never conceived it would happen. We began the project with his cooperation, anticipating that Obama was going to give us a series of interviews. And because his last 2 years were so jammed full of activity, we never got to it. He left the office. He ended up going to Netflix, and so he became off base for us. But he generously told his friends and colleagues to work with us. And so we interviewed 40 people who either knew him or worked with him or went to school with him or had some connection. I think had we interviewed those people back in 2012 or 13, we would have had completely different interviews. The word would have gotten out, you know, avoid this, stay away from this. I mean, you've got to remember when you mention these terrible racial incidents that are happening now with the Floyd story, Trayvon Martin kind of ushered that in, and mm-hmm. and Obama, you know, just for saying a simple line like he could have been my son, triggered a whole national conversation. So you're right. This film does have more import today than it would have had. I think we now know where we're going. We saw what Obama's presidency unleashed. We saw the fact that kind of the hatred that was bubbling beneath the floorboards rise up and come to the forefront. So I think we're much more realistic today about how much racial unrest and hatred and white supremacy and anger is floating around this country than we were when Obama was still in office.
And Jelani, as a journalist and someone who, you know, was able to observe Obama up close. I wasn't in the White House Correspondents Association at that point, but covering him in Congress and so forth. I mean, we know, you know, when you see people up like front, like they get more complicated, as you said. I was just wondering what some of your reactions to. You know, like the Bobby Rush comments again, Obama is a transcendent political figure in our history, in world history, and Bobby Rush is still pissed about 2000, it sounds like.
Sure. I think, you know, Bobby Rush was really interesting, you know, because he knew him in a way that nobody else did. He knew him as an antagonist. And not only that, he knew him as someone whom he had defeated politically. By a lot. But I think that, and you know, and Rush pointed to, I think, a reality that, you know, I tried to get at in the film too, which is that people thought of Obama as kind of meta-political. They certainly thought of him as meta-racial, but they didn't realize that he operated on the same sorts of prerogatives that any other politician operates on. You know, my friend today may not be my friend tomorrow. And that's exemplified, you know, by the Bobby Rush situation. And at the same time, I think that it's crucial to show something else about Obama, which is that, you know, Bobby Rush's, you know, victory indicated a soft spot in Obama's support. And, you know, the kind of completely adoring, vehemently protective relationship that he ultimately cultivated with Black America might not have been possible were it not for the fact that he lost in that race against Bobby Rush. And it says something about who he is as a political figure. To be able to understand that, to be able to assimilate that information, and then be able to move on in a way that allows him to do the exact opposite, to become this person whose Black identity is complicated. It's maybe atypical, it's a kind of boutique experience for him, but by and large is overwhelmingly accepted as part of the rubric of what makes up Black America. And he's accepted by Black people. And so I think that says something really significant about who he is.
I was also struck by the Jeremiah Wright comments, where he seemed genuinely hurt mm-hmm. by what happened when, you know, as a politician, Obama had to push him to the side in order mm-hmm. to put that episode behind. And Wright, I think he understood, but there was real pain in those. Yeah. When he's recounting what his relationship with Obama, and that's again complicated, right?
It was complicated, and I mean, I think that the pain was legitimate. You know, when I was working, I wrote a book that came out in the course of the first term, And when I was talking with people, I didn't get a chance to talk with Wright, but I did talk with people who were close to Wright. And you know, there was this real feeling that he had been wounded by the whole Obama affair. And you know, not only that, it lent itself to a kind of mercenary idea about Obama, that you could read his life and, you know, going from Occidental to Columbia, going from Columbia to the South Side of Chicago, to Harvard Law, to all of these places, that it almost seemed to be scripted, you know, that this was a person who was plotting a particular kind of rise. I don't know that that really holds up. And it seems that his relationship with Jeremiah Wright was, you know, indeed a sincere one, but an authentic one. But critics of his at that point, and not all of them white, you know, certainly not most of them white at this point.
In the film, Laura Washington says, you don't write a book, an autobiography at 30 if you don't have a plan.
Right. And and I think that, you know, the idea of him having a plan was maybe something people could live with. But I mean, if you pick your church based on what's politically feasible for you, then, you know, maybe it says something else about this person. And, you know, again, I can't say that that's true or not true, but it certainly became one of the things that Obama's critics seized upon. And, you know, subsequently, all the way through his presidency, when people had disagreements with him, when they talked about his limitations in particular ways, they would go back to Jeremiah Wright. It's like, well, you see what happened in that moment, and so on.
Yeah, go ahead, Peter, please.
I'm going to add to what Jelani said, which when we arrived at his house to do the interview, while the camera was being set up, I sat at the kitchen table with him. He was deeply hurt. He had never spoken out about this before. He was nervous about speaking with us. He felt that his whole life's reputation was kind of destroyed by this event, that he'd never be seen for what he had done prior to the tapes coming. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the interview, I said to him, what would you like to say to Obama if he hadn't spoke to him since? And he said, I'd just like to speak to him. He felt wounded, he felt hurt, and he felt like he missed a friend. So it was a kind of a combination of deep hurt and love that had been kind of pushed aside, and he'd like to kind of try to bring it back. It was very moving to sit across from him.
I was struck by the how much some of the particularly the political figures struggled. People whose, you know, reputations are stellar. You know, I mean, John Lewis. The footage you have of him talking about his struggle with, you know, a bit kind of abandoning the Clintons, and moving towards supporting Obama, and how much he struggled with that. You know, Lewis is as close to a secular saint as we get, and he seemed, you know, really to struggle even years past with the kind of the demonstration of loyalty there.
I lived in John Lewis's district at that time, and the amount of criticism he received was titanic. You know, his district went overwhelmingly for Barack Obama, and he had this very long-standing personal relationship with the Clintons. And I think it was just, you know, being in one paradigm while another paradigm is taking root. In, you know, the traditional sense of it, Black politicians were trying to build up a favor bank, you know, have people who owe you favors and, you know, develop these relationships and with powerful, influential whites. And here is this person, a kind of model of doing business politically that nobody had conceived of before. And it was easier for John Lewis's district to immediately say that they were interested in Obama. It was easier for them than it was for John Lewis, you know, because John Lewis had built up, and not only him, you know, but, you know, lots of other really respected people and honorable people who were banking on a Hillary Clinton presidency as a means of cashing in 10 or 15 or 20 years of political capital that they had built up. And so you understood the political calculations of it. And at the same time, you saw the historic implications of what was happening. And ultimately, John Lewis came around, as most people did, came around to supporting Obama. But that period, especially in the primaries in 2008, was very tense. And even when he went around in the district and was just kind of the normal tides of praise that he would get when now mixed in with criticism about, oh, well, you really should be supporting Senator Obama.
And also, speaking of Atlanta, I couldn't help but notice it, because I'm a complete nerd when it comes to politics, that when in the scenes when you all are filming election night at the Ebenezer Church in Atlanta, Martin Luther King Jr.'s church, that there is one point where, you know, that they're about to announce that Obama is the projected winner. And there is a person standing at the preacher's dais who kind of jerks his head like this real quick. And that is current Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat from Georgia, who won one of the two Georgia runoffs in January and gave the Democrats a 50-50 Senate in the majority because of Biden and Kamala Harris's win. So I don't know if that was intentional, if you had that in the mind to make sure you got Warnock in there. Again, this stuff is in post-production for a while, but my hat is off as somebody who covers Congress to get the junior senator from
Georgia. I missed that.
Oh yeah, well, it's in there. It's in there.
Well, Peter, you didn't miss that. That was totally intentional. Remember, we talked about it.
Okay. I'm curious about your feelings about this, because I mean we mentioned this long overdue true reckoning, I think, over race. We're talking about it in a way, particularly after Floyd's murder, that we hadn't, even though it has always been there in American politics. But we have so much going on. I mean, legislatures across the country are contemplating voting restrictions. That would primarily affect minority voters. We're debating, the Senate is going to debate this campaign elections overhaul bill. The Voting Rights Act was struck down by the Supreme Court, still not renewed by Congress. And lurking, out there is Donald Trump, who again sort of weaponized racism in politics. This is a long question, and I apologize. But what has happened? What happened to us? Is this the backlash to Obama?
I'll just say a short answer, and let Jelani give you the in-depth analysis. But yeah, I think there was a backlash to Obama, and I think the day he was elected, the backlash began. I think it grew steadily and culminated in the election of Donald Trump. And I think once Trump was in office, all kinds of things were allowed to surface and come out. But it's probably, if you look at the longer historical span of time, it's probably one of many backlashes over centuries that it's an unresolved issue that I've been reading over the past few weeks about how Texas, for instance, is changing its textbooks to change the narrative of race in Texas history. And to me, that's just a small example of how misinformation gets conveyed from one generation to the next, and the problems don't get fixed. They get continued by children, just like they're following their parents. So I think it's a much bigger backlash, but I think it truly came out now because of our first Black president. Mm-hmm.
No, I think Peter's right. What we were looking at in 2008 was intoxicating, as we saw this political development happen that I think nobody anticipated. And at the same time, I had a conversation with a number of conversations where people, even in that moment, were wary of what the implications of it would be. And people in the civil rights community were worried about the future of the Voting Rights Act, which turned out to be prescient. In Obama's second term, we saw the Supreme Court gut the Voting Rights Act and even cite his election as a rationale for gutting the Civil Rights Act. And so that happens. We see a weaponization of race that really begins in his second term, politically speaking, and only gains steam from there, gains momentum from there. Not to be overlooked as part of this backlash is, I think, the high profile incidents of racial violence that we've seen, the mass shootings, most notably at Emmanuel AME, but subsequently at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and at the Walmart in El Paso, getting into the Trump era, and Charlottesville, the racist motifs that we saw in the January 6th insurrection. And so there's a kind of stations of the cross effect in looking at all the things that came from Obama. And in understanding the history of race in this country and how it operates, we should not have been surprised by any of it. But it's disconcerting nonetheless to see ourselves caught up in the same cyclical recurrence of racial violence, racial antagonism, restriction on rights, impeding access to the ballot box, and all of it being done while still referring to ourselves as the benchmark democracy in the world.
And I'm going to have to wrap up. I do want to say that I feel like this no documentary or book is going to explain things or set things right. But like I have to say that this what you all have accomplished with this. With this documentary series, with the focus on Obama, and particularly the way that it's framed with the that particular speech about race, I think it will stand as a real marker for how we look at race in politics. And my hat is off to you for your accomplishment, and thank you very much for talking about your project. Thank you out there for listening to this edition of Political Theater's podcast. Interview contents, AFI Docs, copyright 2021, courtesy of American Film Institute.